I'm Ricky Inslee. I'm the community manager for USENIX, and I thought we would just start off by doing brief introductions, and then I'll ask some questions, and then we'll have some open discussion toward the end where, you know, you all might have questions or topics you'd like to discuss. So would you like to introduce yourself?
I'll start with me. I knew there was a problem being over here. I'm Jennifer Ashpool. I'm a system administrator. I'm a contractor at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. You'll read that I've worked on VAX. It's nice to know I'm not the only one that's worked on a VAX. VAX, SUNS, Linux, and beating up users.
Hi, my name is Sherry Moore. Currently, I work for Google. Prior to that, I started my career at Intel, and then I went to work for Sun Microsystems for 14 years. So a lot of the systems that you guys know and love, they are my babies. So since then, I have to move on to Google. So now I work in the Google Fiber team.
I'm Margot Seltzer. I'm on the faculty of Harvard's Computer Science Department. I'm also an architect at Oracle Corporation, and as of yesterday at about 5 o'clock, I'm also now the USENIX board president.
My name is Jessica McKellar. I work at Oracle through by way of an acquisition, as does everyone at Oracle, of a tiny startup out of MIT called K-Splice that has a technology for rebootless kernel updates. So that's where I work now, and I appear to be representing the Youth Guard. So,
the first question I was going to ask, I think once you have experience, even if it's limited experience, once you've been in the field and whatever subfield you're in computing and navigated whatever corporation you're in or project, you get some bits of wisdom along the way. And so looking back on when you started in your current position or in this career, what do you wish you would have known then that you know now? What bit of advice would you give yourself back then that would have been helpful? Would you like to start?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Would you like to start? I made her start the last one. That was hard.
I think as a female engineer especially, I think one thing is definitely to market yourself. And there are many ways to market yourself, not just going to presentations and going to your boss or upper management. There's a way of marketing which is really well respected among other engineers, especially if you're the only female among a crowd, is that tell people the hard problems that you have been solving. This can happen at lunchtime in the hallway. Always tell people with enthusiasm that this is a really difficult problem and this is how I solved it. Isn't that cool? And when you do that, you gain so much respect from other engineers that will naturally promote you. I think that's one thing that I definitely wish I had known back when I started at Intel, when I was MTS3 when I first joined Sun. And I think later on, once I learned that, I think my career had advanced tremendously. So
I think the one piece of advice I wish I had given myself is it's okay to ask questions or be confident enough to ask questions. So I was a young engineer at Stratus, and I'd been asked to do this fairly straightforward task, and there was a part I just fundamentally didn't understand. And instead of going to my boss and saying, hey, I'm actually really confused, I don't understand how to do this, I did something really stupid. So if you're a kernel hacker, I put a busy waiting loop in the kernel. And when I went and had my code review, my boss looked at me and she goes, you didn't ask, did you? I'm like, no. And she's like, you could have just asked. And you know, it was really obvious advice, but I think for a variety of reasons, and it's not just us, the guys have this problem too, you know, it feels like you're suddenly stupid if you have to ask a question. It's really not the case. You can actually be really smart to know what questions to ask. So I think being confident enough to ask questions and get them answered as opposed to going off and doing stupid things is a really, really important thing to do.
All right, in my limited experience. To make a sweeping generalization, I think that you should just say, if you have opportunities in front of you, you should say yes to everything. Like if you're torn up about this is out of my league, this is too reachy, you should just say yes to it. Commit to the conference talk. Go to the dangerous startup. Just do, if people want you, if people think that people are seeing the capability in you, you should just say yes and don't freak out about it and agonize it over it too much. Is that fair? You shouldn't actually say yes to everything that everybody asks you, but you get the intent, right? So if you are worrying about it being too much of a reach, just do it.
I have a follow-up question for you, since you are young in a field that you know, where women are a minority. What has been your experience as far as being a young woman, you know, in such a male-dominated field, as far as being taken seriously or assumptions that people might have when they first meet you?
So sort of in the startup scene, I think the situation has actually definitely gotten better. And if you surround yourself by people who are actually smart and want to succeed and want to have successful startups, they want the best people. And if you are the best person, they're not going to give you weird grief because you're a woman. The places where people assume that I'm in HR are places like conferences or on the internet, but not with the real people that I work with day to day. I'm working with young people, and I hesitate to talk about a generational difference there, but the negative things are often involve the people that I'm not actually working with, who are older and further away from me actually doing my day-to-day work. So the situation is great on the ground.
Well, I'm in my 40s, and I'm happy to say that, and that I started in this field from a journalism background, but in my late 20s. And so now that I told you how old I am, I will say now that you all are older than she is,
yes.
Looking back at you know, when you got started in this field, what were your experiences as a young woman, and do you see any changes, you know, now that you've been in this field, and how young women, you know, are treated when they come in?
So I'll jump on that one. So in general, I feel that I've been both pretty fortunate, and I've also made my own fortune, and that I've always been pretty comfortable with who I was. I tell the story about the smart girl. So both, I have two brothers who are a lot older than I am, and when they were in high school, they were both the salutatorian of their class, both having been beaten by the smart girl. And so I grew up in a culture where there was no question. I had to be the smart girl. It wasn't an option. It was just, that was my role. And so it never like entered my mind that I was weird because I was doing computers, even though I was, you know, one of three women in the entire program. And I think, so what that did is I had an attitude that I belonged, and so why would anyone question that? At the same time, I have met idiots. My favorite story along those lines was the first company I worked at after college is long gone, but a bunch of us had gotten our own coffee machine because the company coffee was wretched. And so I used to buy the coffee, and my colleague Alan, who was male, bought the cream. So a new guy started, and we invited him to join our coffee club, and it was, you know, Margot does the coffee, Alan does the cream, we charge a quarter a cup, whatever. So one day he comes into my office and he says, "We're out of cream." And I said, "Oh, I do the coffee, Alan does the cream." Later that day, he comes into my office and he says, "We're out of cream." Like, "Mike, what don't you get? I do the coffee, Alan does the cream. This is not complicated." And he said, "Well, I can't bother him with that." And I looked at him and I said, "You can bother me?" And I said, "Get out of my office." So that was step number one, right? You know, there's no reason for you to put up with any crap. Don't do it. So he left. So I run into him later in the day, and I'm like, "Don't even talk to me. I'm still really mad at you." And he says, "Could you get me a cup of coffee?"
No, really.
And I walked into my manager's office, and I said, "Asshole, fix it." Those weren't my exact words, but that was the message. And they did. And he was reprimanded. He was told that was totally inappropriate. I think that's one of those situations that could have gotten out of control if I hadn't just been very clear that this was like way, way, way over the line. And this was 1983. This was a long time ago. So I think there's a huge amount of power you can bring by just not accepting things that are not okay. And laughing at them, because he ended up looking bad, not me.
Would you like to go first?
I can have him repeat the question. Could you repeat the question, please?
I was asking about if you're looking back at when you started in technology, how you were treated or how young women were treated
right.
compared to now, and if you see any changes.
I think I have, as usual, I'm the exception that proves the rule. Looking back, I've realized all the sysadmin teams I've been on been mostly women with an occasional man. So it's been two women and a guy. Now our team is 4 women, 6 guys, so the guys are finally taking over. But most of those, I had management support, I had government support, so it's really kind of funny, I don't see it. I saw it when I was an astronomy physics major. Oh, you're the girl. Oh, you're the only girl in the computer, in the physics programming class. You're one of 2 girls in E&M. That's electricity and magnetism. I think I saw it more there than I did once I got out into the real world. And because I saw it there, I knew how to react when I got into a work situation, which was, no, deal with it, go away. And I think some of that also came from the fact my father always expected me, nope, Jennifer, you can do whatever you want to do. Don't let the guys get to you. So that helped. So I'm the exception, as usual.
So I actually went to college in China. So in China, thanks to the communism environment, they actually wanted the slogan we call it is that women can support half the sky. And all my life we were told that. And in college, half the class was women. I was in an engineering class. So we were never treated any differently. We were expected to excel just as like any other students. We were never given an excuse to not to be the best just because we were female. So actually that became kind of weird when I came here for grad school, because like there were only 2 girls in the whole computer engineering division. And then when we aced all our classes, and other, you know, guys were like, oh, you guys just worked hard. So it's like, well, just because you suck at it, you know, doesn't mean that you're smart, you know. So I think I have a 14-year-old daughter now. So now I'm very conscious about not letting her get away with anything, not like acing her classes just because, you know, she thinks, oh, I'm just not good at it because I'm a girl. I said, that's never an excuse. That's just an easy way out. That's just because it's so much easier to say, I'm just not good at it, than putting in all the hard work to excel, to be number one. So I think as a society, if you don't don't give the young ladies that excuse, just tell them that you are expected to do just as well, they will naturally do it. And I think just like, you know, with Jessica, I don't think any guys in your company actually think of you as a girl. It's just like when I joined the Colonel group, I was the only girl in the Colonel group. I don't think anybody treated me any differently just because I was female. Just like I don't take many things too seriously or do too personally. I don't go running away, go, oh, they're being mean to me. You know, I think they're just treating me like another person. They expect me to be competent and to do my job. They don't want to give me an excuse to not be good at it, to be, you know, absolutely, you know, perfect, just like they treated, you know, everyone else. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answered the question.
Oh,
but
yeah. Well, and it's interesting the cultural differences that you bring up, you know, where background makes a big difference. You know,
yeah.
if you have parents or an academic setting that sets the tone for you, it can make
That's
all
right.
the difference.
Yep.
Leslie brought up something in her talk earlier this morning that I think interested a lot of us. Act as if, that concept, you know, that it's along the lines of imposter syndrome, you know, that I think a lot of women are aware of. Is there anyone who hasn't heard of imposter syndrome? Okay. Is there anyone who has imposter syndrome? Okay. It's imposter syndrome is, I'm not an expert on it, but a lot of women in tech fields or academics have imposter syndrome, where they feel like people are going to figure out that they're a fraud and they don't really know what they're doing. And it's just this, it's not even a lack of confidence, because these are obviously intelligent, educated, you know, women who are experts, but they have a feeling that they're acting like an imposter. And I didn't know about it. And then when I first read about it, I was like, oh, that's me. And I found that a lot of women are like that. So anyway, my question is along those lines. Have you had those experiences in your career of having to act as if, like, perhaps you do know that you could do it, or if you looked at it on paper, you know you have the skill set, but you're not really feeling it. So what experiences have you had with that, where you had to walk in and seem more confident than you were feeling at the time, or? Well, I'll start. I can tell you, I had that at my job at Linux New Media when they first hired me to help open their North American office and launch some magazines and whatever. And I was like, I'm an editor, you know. And I was able to do it, and I knew in my head I could do it. But to me, it was shocking that other people thought I could do it, you know. And so, have you had those kind of experiences where you took on maybe a task that you hadn't done yet that you knew you could do, and then you had to come in and, you know, show everybody you could do it?
Yeah, one line I love saying, even to all my female colleagues, is that fake it until you make it. So in my job, I have moved around all pieces of the whole system software stack. I started from firmware to OS to application level to everything you can think of. Now I'm into networking. So I think number one is that you really have to believe that, believe in yourself. And number two, just let everybody know, I might not know the answer at this moment, but I know I can figure it out. And like Leslie, you know, left, but you know, I think that's your credit card, right? Later, everybody would know, I would like Sherry to do this, because even though she might not know the answer at this moment, I know she has what it takes to pull it off. So when I was appointed the technical lead for the whole Intel Solaris effort, I was tasked to lead like 20 engineers on each side to do the project. I have never led such a big effort before, but I knew I could do it, and I, like all the whole management chain anonymously, you know, appointed me, right? So I was like, yeah, you know, I feel comfortable. You know, I have never done this before, but I know I can pull it off. So just basically that confidence of believing in yourself and, you know, the experience and support that you will get, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this, for me, this goes back to my earlier comment about just committing yourself to things, even if it's a stretch, because I 100% all the time identify with and know that I struggle with imposter syndrome type things. Like, am I a real kernel engineer? No. Yes. I don't know. Maybe. and part of it is with the people that I work with, I'm sort of working with wunderkind who have come out of MIT programming since they were four. And I, compared to them, got a late start by starting programming in college. And so I definitely sort of acutely feel that I am playing catch up and have to work harder to close that gap. Now that motivates me. It means I work really, really hard every day to get myself up to the point that to compensate for the time, the extra time that they've had. But this also means, but part of the way that I address that is by agreeing to do things, even if they seem really hard for me, because that commits me to it. And then once I do it and I've proven to myself that I've done it, great. Okay, that is a data point that I could do it. And then once you stack up enough of those data points, that helps you reflect. When you start doubting yourself, you can reflect back on that and know that you can do it. So that's part of how I compensate for that.
Can I just add that my male colleagues actually also feel that same way?
Yes.
It really is not just the women.
I agree. And I think it's more common with women, but there are definitely plenty of men who deal with it also.
I actually have a good story to tell. Caroline can probably relate to this. So when I started my career in grad school, not really my career, that's how I put myself through college, but through grad school, I worked as a systems trader. And my husband, at the time, he was the lead systems trader. So one day there was this, you know, the big server went down. So we're all called in at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I sat in front of since I was brand new, so I had to do all the typing. He said, okay, do this. And then he said, okay, do that. And then he said, okay, do this one thing. And then I said, do that. I said, oh, still not working. And he said, well, I guess I don't know. So what? You told me to type all that at, like, you know, a production server, and you don't even know?
Male answer syndrome.
Exactly. So, you know, just like Emily said, well, all the male colleagues do it the same way. You fake it until you make it.
Yeah, I think sometimes they're not quite as aware that they're faking it, though. So I am.
If they have fixed it, they would say, "See, I knew what I was doing all along."
So there's this one. So I advise a lot of students, and I at one point had these two students, one man, one woman, who were both truly, truly brilliant. And they were actually a couple as well. And she was my advisee, and she came in, and she'd been taking operating systems, which is like the killer course in our curriculum. And she's like, you know, I just really don't get it as much as the guys do. So I said, I'm going to say a quote to you, and I want you to tell me what you think about it. And I said, you know I get good grades, and everybody tells me I'm really good, but at some point they'll all figure out I'm not. And her eyes got wide, and she looked at me, and she goes, oh, my God, that's exactly what I feel like. And this was before I actually knew the term imposter syndrome. And so I actually would try that on a lot of my women students. And my favorite response from a guy was, yeah, I could imagine people feeling that way. But I never once had a guy go, oh, my God, yeah, I feel that way all the time. And then I told this woman student my little secret. I said, okay, next time when you go into class, I said, I want you to actually listen to the answers that the guys are giving. Because it was true. The guys would answer every single question. And I have a habit of making sure that nobody ever feels stupid, and so I try not to, people never actually give wrong answers in my class. I will find that grain of truth in them and focus on that and then tell the right answer. So I said, pay attention, like, for the next couple days in class and what they really know versus what it sounds like they know. And she came back a week later, she goes, oh my God, you're right. I know just as much as they do. I was like, yes. So, you know, you can combat the imposter syndrome. Part of it is, you know, embrace your inner imposter. Then you can conquer her.
And this is true, but awareness really made a big difference for me. Mm-hmm. So just, if you feel like there are women in your life who need to be told that this is something they should reflect on, it really makes a big difference to be aware that this is a thing that you're doing mentally to yourself.
Can I add something?
Hold on.
Grad school at Harvard, my husband talked about this. And the thing is, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And that's why you feel like a fraud, because you're so aware of what you don't know, so it decreases what you do know. Thank you.
Did anybody have anything to add to that? Okay. Well, along those same lines, we were talking earlier today about speaking up, you know, in meetings or speaking first. And that is something that I had to work on earlier in my career also, where I would not talk at meetings and speak up. And so I was wondering if you've had those experiences with yourself or if you've observed that with other women where you knew they knew the answers, that they had contributions, but they weren't speaking up. And so, you know, what have you observed? And then what would your advice be or experience? What has your experience been with it?
So as might be clear, I've never really had the problem not speaking up, but one of my best friends in grad school was the only woman in a group, and I was not in that group, but what I would hear from her and her male counterparts was that, you know, she would say, let's do X. The advisor would not hear it. One of the guys would say, let's do X, and he would hear it. And the best thing that ever happened in that group was one day one of the other students just looked at his advisor and said, why do you do that? And the advisor was taken aback and said, do what? He said, she just said that 5 minutes ago and you ignored her. He said it and you said it was a good idea. And the advisor was like, really? And he really had no clue that he did that, but it had become a pattern. And fortunately, the other guy spoke up. And I think that's the most important thing, is somebody in the room's got to speak up and say, actually, so-and-so said that. And it was funny, I had this happen to me once. I was on this panel about leadership and engineering. And here I am with, you know, some high-ranking guy in the military and, you know, some executive here. And I don't even remember what the topic was, but I had said something. And then somebody, two people down, said, well, when, you know, Joe here said thus and such. And I caught the eye of another woman in the audience who was just like, and I'm sitting there. And I didn't say anything, and one of the other guys on the panel actually spoke up. So, well, actually, no, Margo said that. And in some sense, I think part of our jobs is to watch when it's happening to other people and speak up for them, because it's so much more powerful when a third party observes that you've done something really stupid and embarrassing. And so, you know, be that third party, do it for other people, whether it's a man or a woman, and ideally, you know, there are the wonderful men in the room who are here. That's actually one of those things you can do for your female colleagues, is if you see other people doing that, it's a great thing to point out, because it's really, when it comes from a third party, it's incredibly jarring, because the people who are doing it, they really, really don't know they're doing it. They really don't. Mm-hmm.
I'm about ready to get off of a nonprofit board, and about 4 years ago, I had finally sent out an email and said, you know, I say something, you guys ignore me. There's another female on the board with me. There's not, you know, seven guys, two. And I did this long tirade. It's great doing a tirade in email. You don't see the reactions. So the vice president came back and said, really? We're doing that? I said, yeah. And so it noticed after the previous meeting, the next few meetings, Ted was really making sure, no wait, Jennifer said that, and actually was making sure other people said it. And we actually had this problem where it's not sometimes the women, sometimes there's some quiet guys that never got to say anything. And obviously I don't have a problem speaking out really, but I know that when I've led a meeting and I kind of look and a guy will say something, so, well, no, I think so-and-so has something to say, and the woman will just kind of do like this and go, oh, right, and she'll say it, and the guy's kind of like, oh, because they sometimes get their blinders on, but I had to speak up for myself because really the other seven guys didn't get a clue, so.
So I do have a trick or an advice if you're in a meeting with a lot of people that you might not already know, like not you're part of your company, be the best dressed person in the meeting because they always look to that person for acknowledgement. Every time I have a meeting with AMD, with Intel, with all the vendors, I always make sure that I wear a suit, and they always look to me for acknowledgement. And I will always go, okay, yes, that's right.
That's brilliant. I have an observation that's a little bit sad, actually, and it's not about adults, it's about kids. Weirdly, because I'm not a teacher, but I'm going to be helping teach an elective class at a high school in the Boston area in computing. And one of the things we did is brought a bunch of kids from this school interested in taking the class to Google, actually, to show off how sweet working at Google is, and then to have them brainstorm topics they would want to cover during this elective class. And it was really striking. There were a bunch of girls came along with a bunch of boys, and it was really striking to me that on the tour, the girls were all at the back of the tour. When we were talking with Google engineers, they were at the back of the group. They didn't suggest topics. They didn't raise their hands, and I had to shunt them to the front to ask engineers questions and call on them to get their opinions on things. And so it's sad that this is high school girls, and so it starts really early, not wanting to step forward. And so whatever we can do for the girls that we know and culturally and in school, it takes a lot of concerted effort, but it starts really young, and if we can combat it young, it would be good for everyone.
And I have to share this story. So I have a 14-year-old son who plays WoW, World of Warcraft. And it's kind of cool to see your 14-year-old leading raids with, there are all these adults playing, and that's actually kind of cool. And then it came out one night at dinner, and by the way, those of you who know my son, you are not allowed to repeat this in public. But it turns out that he plays with a voice synthesizer, and it makes him a 28-year-old woman. And I said, so why is that? And he said, well, if you're a guy and you tell people what to do, they tell you to shut the F up. And if you're a woman, they listen to you. So there's something to that. And whatever it is, we should take advantage of it.
Well, on that topic of high school girls, we'll just go ahead and segue into that because that's, I'm the parent of a high school girl who may or may not be in this room right now. And I think about this topic a lot because I got into technology on my own. I got my first computer after I graduated from college, and submitted all my papers on typewriter. And I thought it was nice because it was electric back then. So things have changed quite a bit. So when you look at high school now, what do you think the key is for, and we're just talking about, high schools in your area perhaps, what do you think would be helpful to get more girls interested in technology or to at least make sure they have that option? Because not everyone's going to be interested in it, but to make sure they're exposed to technology.
Okay. It's such a hard problem to unpack. I do a lot of STEM volunteering, often with younger girls, like middle school age girls. One thing that's really awesome is I ask them, like I've asked them before, I ask every year, does anybody ever tell you that you can't do math? Or does anybody ever tell you that you can't go into science? And they laugh at me. They're like, what are you even talking about? Of course we can do math. So at that level, they have confidence in their abilities, and they know that those opportunities are available to them. I mean, something is still happening in middle school and in high school, and I've read Unlocking the Clubhouse. I don't have the answers. I don't know.
I had just done a talk with another friend of mine to a middle school gifted and talented education expo, and we were talking about model rockets. And these two girls came up to me. They didn't go up to my friend, Kevin, and they said, "We really want to be astronauts. How do we be astronauts? What do we have to do?" And I'm like, "Okay, you know, you got to email me, and we're talking about it." And I'm thinking, now, did they come up to me because I'm the female, or did they come up to me because I was closest to them? And I think it's because they saw, oh, yeah, she really does rockets. She does this. She works at NASA. She does these things. So I think sometimes you, to get to some of the high schoolers, if you just go out there and go, look, I'm having fun working on computers. I'm having fun building model rockets. And yet I still do girl things like make quilts and other things. It gets them, the kids to go, or the girls to go, oh, okay, so I'm not weird that I think math and science and chemistry is fun. So it was just something that was kind of weird. I kind of had to think about it and go, okay, well, why are you asking me? Is it because I'm the NASA person or I'm the female? I didn't ask him why, but it was, I think part of it is you just have to get out there and go, it's okay to do this. It's all right. It's okay not to do it. It's okay to do it. And I think when I went through my astronomy and physics, I had professors that were female, became astronomers in the 1940s and 50s, and would tell stories of, look, I was told I was never going to get any telescope time because I was a woman, and you're not going to be that way. So when you have mentors, it's always a good thing. So maybe you can somehow figure out how to mentor them is always good.
So as I mentioned, I have a 14-year-old girl. I don't know if she's going to get into engineering. I hope so. But I try to be a good role model, so I want to show her that I'm having a lot of fun. I'm really good at this. I actually sometimes will bring her to conferences. When I speak, she will be in the audience, so she can see that, wow, you know, I can command the whole audience. I know my stuff, you know. And I bring her to work all the time. She comes to Google, came to Sun, actually Sun a lot more. You know, I ran all kinds of labs. She watched me do bring up. So she knows that it's possible. Not only is it possible, you can be as good as you want to be at it. And I have a lot of really good friends, like Caroline is a good example, you know. So she knows a lot of other female who are also in engineering, in the tech industry. So I really hope, you know, this stays with her, that she would believe in herself, that she can be as good as she wants to be in science and technology, in anything that she wants to be. So mm-hmm. I think that's what I aim to do, and I hope other people can share their experience. I think you have a girl who is also in engineering. Some lady here was mentioning that. I was like, oh, I would like to talk to you about this.
Well, it does seem like mentoring is a big key, you know, to helping get more girls and students involved in technology. And so that's a nice segue to what mentors have you had? Like, how have you found your mentors? And, you know, how does somebody go about finding a mentor? And then, you know, we heard earlier talking about short-term mentors versus long-term mentors, you know. And so I'd like to hear some of your experiences. Did you just have female or male mentors, or have you had a mix? I mean, how's it worked for you? Margo, how about you start? You didn't answer that last one. So.
Sure. So, I mean, the first person I would actually describe as a mentor was actually, he had been a professor when I was an undergrad, and then he actually left the same time I did and ended up consulting at the company I went to, and so we ended up working together. And this was in 1983. He and I are actually now, today, still 30 years later, writing a grant proposal together. And mostly it wasn't so much, you know, yeah, he wrote me letters for grad school, but he totally believed in me. And it was one of these, it was never even all that explicit. It was just, oh, she's really good, and so I want her on my team. But he was, you know, instrumental in what happened to me over the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. So he was very clearly a mentor. I had the oddest graduate advisor ever, so we'll just skip that chapter. I mean, we have a great relationship now, but it was just weird. Turns out I look a lot like his wife, and I think that was always a problem. it took me years to understand that, and then I was like, oh, okay, now I get it. And then, you know, when I was a young faculty member at Harvard, there were two senior faculty who basically made it clear that their job in life was to help me succeed. You know, they couldn't do my job for me, but they would run interference or do whatever they could, and they didn't really know what that was, but they were there for me. And again, I think it was more the implicit message of we believe in you and we'll do what we can, more than anything explicit. And you know, it's a great line. I use that with my new junior colleagues all the time, which is, look, I have tenure. My goal now is just to help you succeed. Doesn't really matter what happens to me. It's all about you. And I think that kind of faith that you can help in your junior colleagues is just great.
She looked like she was going to say something. So I have a degree in astronomy and physics. I go to work at NASA. I'm doing data analysis. I'm talking to scientists, and I'm bored out of my mind. So there was this program that the company had started called Circle Mentoring. And what they did is they took a group of people, if you had something you were interested in, then they would find a manager that was not in your direct management chain. So my company had contracts at NOAA and at NASA. So I had a NOAA manager come in and he was circle mentoring some of us. There was a group of us who were all like, we're bored with our job, we don't know what we want to do. So he mentored us and like, look, go. This your assignment is to go find somebody you want to talk to. And I said, okay. So I went to our system administrator because I didn't know whether I wanted to do web programming, to which I'm not very good at programming. I can hack, but that's about it, or system administration. So I went and talked to Laura Carrier, who was the system administrator there, right before she goes on maternity leave. She comes back 5 months later and goes, we need to finish that conversation. And she'd offered me a job. She remembered, she goes, you have the same skill set I do, you have a degree in physics. Come over, be a system administrator, I know you can be good at it. So she really gave me the opportunity, but really when I think back, it was that manager at NOAA, who even though the circle mentoring is not all women, it was mixed, it was, you know, guys, girls, it was great. But it was like, oh, he said, no, this is how you go figure it out. Go do it, come back, and of course, you know, what happens in circle mentoring and is discussed there stays there. But you feel free to be able to go, well, I want to go do this. And he's feel free to go, yeah, I don't think that's going to be good. But he's like, go talk to a web programmer, go talk to a system admin, and figure it out from there. So then once Laura hired me, she was obviously a very good mentor. She had me start coming to Lisa. And then from there, I found a couple of others. But it was a company thing of circle mentoring. Take a group of people who want to do something, find a manager who's not in their direct relation, and he can look at you from an outside point of view, yet still figure out what you want to do for the company. So it was structured, but it was great. And I think about it back now, I said I would either be banging my head up against a wall because I'd be bored out of my mind if I hadn't had that, because that really got me to think about what else I could do in the company, what else I wanted to do. So it was great.
I'm going to represent the people who've never, I haven't had a ton, like my parents aren't technical, my dad's a musician, my mom's a substitute teacher, and I was like a really serious kid starting it. Like we have pictures of me at 2 wearing like an acid wash jean jumper thing with a lunchbox sitting on the corner of our house, because what I wanted to do was watch the school bus go by. Like I knew I couldn't go to school yet, but I wanted to, so I wanted to watch the school bus. So I was a really serious kid who wanted to study since I was really young. And I didn't have a lot of explicit mentorship, but something that was true for me that has been true for a lot of women that I've talked to who end up in computing is that they had technical teachers in school who were women. So the science Olympiad coach and the chemistry teacher were women. My calculus teacher was a woman, and she also ran the math team. So I may not have gotten that structure from my parents or from my family, but I did get that in high school, a little bit at least. And I don't know how important that was for me, but I mean, here I am today, so yeah.
So something worked.
Something worked, yeah, in the system.
Another topic that I've thought about quite a bit is when you were talking about how you dress when you go to meetings and whatever, yeah. And I've noticed quite a bit when there are articles about successful or, you know, influential women in technology, they often lead in with a description of how they look or what they're wearing or their heels. And, you know, and I like cute shoes as much as the next person who likes cute shoes, but I'm wondering how have you noticed appearance and dress and that sort of thing affecting women in our field when that doesn't seem to be a topic for men. Like, you can show up as a guy pretty much dressed as however, and it's not an issue. You can wear a kilt, and really, it's just not an issue, you know? But with women, there seems to be more of a problem. I mean, I had one woman I talked to where she said she intentionally wore very big, baggy, loose t-shirts, you know, to the expos when she was at a booth, because otherwise guys wouldn't come and talk to her at her booth, you know? So have you noticed any of that, or?
Not getting mistaken for a booth babe is definitely a priority for me at conferences. It's really annoying.
It is.
It's really annoying. And I will be the engineer from the K-Squads group. And I have wonderful teammates who like, their response is, hey bro, I'm not technical. You need to talk to her, actually. So I have strong advocates in my group, but it's actually really annoying and still a problem at conferences. But again, at work, it doesn't. People make fun of me because I dress like Steve Jobs every day. I only wear this every day. So I don't actually think, I don't know anything about clothing and don't think about it. But conferences are the one place where I do have to pay attention.
So I actually tend to dress up more. I actually wear dresses, which is a real problem when you're like running wires on the floor. And part of the reason, though, is that I want the other women to know that it's okay to be a girl. Like, if you want to be a girl and wear dresses, it's okay. You don't have to, right? Mm-hmm. And I do wear socks sometimes, but it's actually okay, because I think that's a message that actually doesn't come across very often. And there are women who like to dress up and wear skirts, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you're not a hacker. But I had one of my students ended up going to, I think it was actually a consulting firm. It was sort of a Beltway Bandit where she was a consultant. And she, you know, I wear dresses. She was fashionable, real difference. And she looked really nice in clothes, and she liked clothes, and she wore nice clothes. And she actually had one of her teammates tell her that dressing nicely was inappropriate. And she, you know, sort of sent me email going, you know, this happened, what do I do? And I said, you know, tell him to go, something I won't repeat here. You know, this is his problem, not your problem. But I think there really is still this problem that if you want to be taken seriously, particularly when you're just starting out, looking too good is a detriment. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sucks.
Can I just add that when I was starting out as a cis admin, sometimes I would wear a skirt. And I noticed that the number of guys who needed me to crawl under their desk actually did increase dramatically on the days I wore a skirt. Well, you know, that kind of trained me not to wear skirts.
I only do it in my own office.
I enjoy wearing skirts. I actually wear skirts to work almost every day, and I feel very comfortable. I wear also really cute shorts, and sometimes even I would tell my daughter, I say, you know, you always dress like, you know, 50-year-old lady. You should, you know, be more like me. So, and then my daughter would say, only old ladies dress up like you. They wear skirts all the time. So, but I feel really comfortable. But whenever I go to a meeting or a more serious, you know, meeting or conference, I do wear my suit and try to look more respectable. Mm-hmm. Like I said, once again, I want to command the meeting. I want everybody to look to me for acknowledgement. So that have really always worked for me. So.
If you show up at my job looking nice, they want to ask when the job interview is. My poor mother couldn't get me to wear dresses when I was 5. So I do wear a dress every now and then. I did promise my husband I'd wear a dress on our wedding day, and I did. So, I mean, this... I'm in a collared shirt. This is dressed up for Goddard. So, you know, it's. I mean, I'm allowed in t-shirts and jeans because we are on the floor and it's expected. Every now and then one of my colleagues likes to wear a skirt just so she goes, I'm sorry, I can't crawl underneath your desk today. You're going to have to wait, or she'll get one of the other guys to do it. But I think because my poor mom could never get me to dress nicely. It just has never bothered me. So I don't dress all in black, but you know, what can I say? But really, if you show up in a suit and tie or even just in nice slacks where I work, and I mean, the scientists have to dress up, but the support staff, if you do, you're like, where are you interviewing?
So actually, I think the dress is also an issue for the guys. So when the guys want to distinguish themselves, they do dress differently so they stand out. Like one of the guys I work with by the name of Stephen Han, you know, he wears a tie to work every single day. And then one day I finally asked, I said, Stephen, why do you always wear a tie to work? This is like, this is the Colonel group. And he was like, because when I'm in a meeting, I want everybody to remember the guy with the tie. I was like, oh, good trick. So.
Yeah, I made the mistake at my old job quite a few years ago. Somebody came in dressed up, and it was a very casual office. And I said, "What, you got a funeral today?" And they did.
Oh.
So I don't do that anymore. That was not good.
Yeah.
Cannot hear you.
Can you, if the stand-up mic works?
I can speak loudly.
No, in the mic.
I was just, Wired had an article today, I'm from Facebook, that our New York office better dresses than our California office, so it's actually become quite a rivalry. I was going to dress nicely, but they told me to wear a hoodie, so I was recognizable.
I have one more question, and I thought maybe we could just go ahead and open it up for discussion after that. And I was talking about this, I think with you earlier today, about negotiating and how you negotiate for different roles at your company, organization, or salary is a big one. And a few years ago, I was talking to my stepfather about the salary issue and how women make less money, and he ran a company at the time, and he said, well, I just hired a man and a woman for the same role, and I'm giving the guy way more money. And I was like, what, you pig? And he was like, well, he asked for more. And that really stuck with me, and I was like, you could do that, And I'm way better about negotiating now. And so I just wanted to hear your opinions on how you negotiate or tips you would have for somebody, because for some reason, women don't seem to be taught how to negotiate.
So I'm terrible at this, but how many people have read the book Women Don't Ask? If you have not read it, go right now, click on your favorite online book retailer and buy it and read it cover to cover now. Then, next time it's time for your annual review or a job interview or anything else, go read the book. The data is there. We don't ask. We don't ask and we don't get, right? There's nothing wrong with asking. If you want a raise, if you want a higher salary, you must ask. And if you haven't read the book, go read the book. I have nothing to do with it. I don't make any money off it, but it's really fabulous.
And not only do you have to ask, but in my experience, I also had all of the reasons to back up, why I got that number, I live in this part of the country and I have this level of experience and, this is the average according to this survey and whatever, but I don't offer that information. I wait until they come and ask, well, where did you get this number? And then I have all of it. And then I'm like, you're getting a good deal. I gave you the friend discount,
Yeah, I actually have a friend who, my soccer team, who is the, right now she's the top soccer producer for ESPN. When she was going to ESPN, she had been a freelancer. She had done all the last World Cups, the Olympics. Soccer is one of the most technically challenging sports to produce. So she's probably one of the best sports producers in the country. And she's going to ESPN, and she was sort of hemming and hawing. And I sat her down, and I sort of gave her the list. Okay, this is why you can ask for whatever you want. And it really hadn't occurred to her. And this is a very confident, accomplished woman, and I sat her down and I gave her the reasons. Here are all the reasons why you can ask for absolutely everything you want. And she went in and she pretty much got it. So, ask.
I was going to say, don't think it only applies to money. When I was talking to Google, I came from a job where I was working 75% time, and I asked for 2 days a week working from home. And Google has a reputation of not letting people work from home, but I asked, I got it.
For the longest time, it was kind of a joke between my husband and I. I made more money than he did. So I don't know where I learned how to negotiate. I think when I was in choir in high school, my choir teacher was always like, look, we want to go. We're going to shoot for the sun in this song. We're going to shoot for the best. And if we don't make it, that's fine. We're going to get to the moon. Because if you just aim for the moon, you might only get in the upper atmosphere. So I think that stuck with me is like always just ask for the extreme and then see what you get. It always turns out you get a little bit more than what you thought. So that kind of stuck with me out of my choir teacher of all things.
So I don't know how many of you have been to China or Beijing. There's a silk market there. The way you bargain, the way they ask, the opening price is always about 200%, you know, twice as more, three times. So the way you negotiate is that you always cut it down to the bare minimum, about 10%. And then if they're unwilling to give that to you, you walk away, find the next one, and then give it them 20%. And some, you know, somewhere around there, you will kind of figure out what the right price is. But always, basically, the lesson, don't ever, if you're a seller, don't ever aim low. If you're a buyer, don't ever aim high. The lesson now I tell my daughter is that always ask for what you want. What's the worst that could happen? They can say no, but if you don't ask, you'll never get it. So.
Do you have you had to do any negotiating yet?
My incredibly limited negotiation. No, well, I have a funny, tiny anecdote, which is I had no notion that you could even negotiate for salaries for my first internship that I applied for. And I had the good fortune of having a boyfriend who was also in CS who told me that I should. And we like planned out the strategy together. And so for my very first internship, which they were not thrilled with me for attempting to do this, but I did try to negotiate the salary for my very first internship as like a sophomore in college. And they grudgingly gave me the money and then changed their policy to never allow that again. But so I was fortunate to have someone who recognized that I wasn't gonna do the best that I could there and guide me. And so a willingness to sort of ask around and get help and look for sort of a role model in the space is definitely helpful. And I'm gonna go read your book. I'm gonna go buy it as soon as we get off here.
Okay, I think we should open it up to some questions. And just make sure you use a mic so that everyone can hear you, and I believe it's getting recorded also. So do we have any questions?
I have
a question. Is everybody awake? Did you guys eat too much? You're in the mid-afternoon lull?
Yeah, we didn't have enough caffeine in the room.
This is why I got the Starbucks. Okay, just checking.
I've been in computer science for almost 30 years now, and one of the things that I did when I first started is the people that saw my talk know that I always thought I was going to be like a pioneer or something, and there was going to be all these women behind me, and we were going to take over the world. But now that I've gotten a little bit older and less mature, it seems like there's just a percentage of women that go into this field. And I don't know, I haven't made a technical study out of this or anything, but do you think that we're always going to be in the minority as we go through the next 25 generations of women, or do you think that more or less women are going to mathematics and science? Because I see less personally, but I'd like to hear the opinion of the board.
So the numbers are appalling. You and I went through it almost the heyday when there were the most women in computer science. The reasons are complicated, but the fact of the matter is, if we look at other countries like China, it doesn't have to be that way. So the question is, what is it about our society that does this? And that's a hard... Yeah, I mean, even in Europe, it's better. But the numbers, the CRA does a study every year, and the numbers are terrible. It's, you know, the leaky pipeline, people opt out. Personally, I think there's one thing that we might be able to do to make it a little bit better here, but until we actually just change the culture completely where it's just expected that half of all the STEM people will be women, I think it's going to be really hard. Part of it, and I think this happens at sort of this mid-career stage, is that sometimes we construct these jobs in ways that you have to make these enormous sacrifices in terms of your personal life. And I think in general, you know, women look at those and go, why should I do that? There are a lot of things I can do and not have to sacrifice my personal life and my kids and everything else and be satisfied. So why wouldn't I do those instead of these? I will embarrass someone in the room, but I won't do it unless she wants to stand up. You know, one of the best engineers I know is a woman who decided that she really wanted to work, you know, about 20 hours a week so she had time with her kids. And she gets more done in those 20 hours than most of my male colleagues get done in a month. And it's all about focus and trade-offs and priorities. And, you know, most of the other men in our engineering group also have families and children, but, you know, only two of them have ever decided to work part-time. So I think part of it is the way we've constructed these jobs makes it actually really hard to have a life. And I want to have a life. I think having a life is good.
I see a lot of women in science, and one of our associate chiefs had twins about a year and a half ago. And then she decided to take the associate chief job, and she's like, I can do it. And she's got support from her husband. And then I have a system administrator, a colleague of mine, who his wife just retired from NOAA after 30 years. And I see that he's like, nope, I'm going to be late. I've got to take my daughter here. I got to take my daughter there. So even though we don't see it broadly, I see it in little pockets that I see a lot of women scientists coming up at Goddard who are like, oh no, I've got my twins and I've got my life and I've got this and I'm doing science and they're doing everything. And then I'm seeing the guys go, oh no, I've got to go off and, you know, the wife's got to go do her career, so I'm going to go do this. Who do it? It's in pockets. I don't think it's going to be this broad swell, but and unfortunately, I think it's how it's going to work. It's going to be little things coming. So I see it at least in the science part, maybe not in the computer part, but I see it at least in the pure science part that, no, we really are. The women scientists are married and have their kids and getting their job and going forward with their career and writing their papers and doing everything. And they're busy and survive off of coffee, but but they've also got great support from their husbands and from their partners. So it's getting there. It's slow. I mean, I think my father had always assumed, nope, Jennifer, you can do whatever you want to. And no, I don't have my PhD, but it's okay. I'm happy with what I'm doing. So it's there. You just have to look for it sometimes.
And sort of to look at it a little bit, to look outside of career and in a little bit different of a space where we're for CS, I think that in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of really positive change in a lot of programming and open source communities. That is a signal to me that we're still eventually going to get there. I mean, I have to be optimistic about this because I devote a ton of my energy to doing programming outreach for women. But I do a lot with a Python programming language, and I'm an organizer for a Python user group. I'm on the Python Software Foundation Board of Directors, and I'm on their Outreach and Education Committee. So I watch this, at least in the Python community, very closely. And I think that there's been a tremendous increase in awareness about the sort of gender disparity and sort of general diversity issues, a big shift in sort of men calling out bad behavior from other men, a lot more support for diversity outreach initiatives within programming communities. So I see a lot of really positive stuff going on. And there are people in the room who are part of like Debian Women and the GNOME outreach program for women, a lot of other really good stuff that's going on. And so that gives me great hope for at least community support for outreach to women. So if the support is there, it then becomes a question of are there women who are going to rise up to take advantage of that support? And that's a tough question, but I think that open source is ready, at least.
I actually want to follow up on Jennifer's point. This might not be happening or might not be as noticeable in computer science or engineering, but I do notice that there are a lot more researchers, or like most of the doctors at the hospital that my family visit are actually female. So I think there are definitely a lot more female in advanced, you know, science or technology fields, not necessarily in computing. But that's, at Google, there are actually a lot of women, right? Sabrina can probably attest, and Kat can attest to that. I think half of the people at Google are actually female. Yeah, do you agree?
In engineering?
Well, it's a technology company, so I don't really know where most of them work, but you know, they definitely. No.
Yeah.
Okay. So I do see really positive signs everywhere. Like Google is definitely. I worked at Intel, Sun, and Oracle. And now Google. Google definitely has to buy most, you know, number of female, just around. So.
I have one comment. My son is at Rochester Institute of Technology in science, and his incoming class was 40% women. Yay. So it may be more the T part of STEM and maybe the E, but not so much the S. But my question is, if any of you have anecdotes on any seminal moment along your path that put you where you are today. When I think back to me, when I was an undergraduate in computer science, you know, you take your introduction program, you know, then you take the weed out course, which was pointers for everybody, and then eventually for me, we got onto AVAX, and in hindsight, it was the first social networking for me where we learned to chat and talk and write, and I could chat with my friends and IM them like instantly if they were on some other terminal across the room, and this was so cool. How does it work? And that put me on a path for operating systems that I have stuck with since then. So I'm wondering if any of you can share, I mean, particularly Jennifer, physics and astronomy, and here you are at a computing conference.
When I was an undergraduate at University of Arizona, I worked at LPL, Lunar and Planetary Laboratories, and they were 6 years behind in their Voyager translation for nine-track tapes. I see nine-track tapes now and I shudder, just because it's the nightmares. I got 6 years of backlog done in two, and I was on the computer and I worked it out and it was doing the translation. I didn't write the program, but my nickname was Data Troll Incorporated because I could get the data out and written like you wanted to for the scientists. And I just realized I had that detail, and it didn't involve higher math, which I was not very good at. I mean, higher, like, you know, 400 level. That I have to tell this story. I was taking a spherical trigonometry, which is what you do in second level astronomy, and I'm talking to my friends about, okay, so on this problem, do you do this, blah, blah, blah. And my mom turns to my dad, I lived at home, my mom turns to my dad and goes, do you understand what she's saying? My dad goes, not a clue. So they're like, okay. So I realized, all right, I know more math than my parents. This is a good thing. But, you know, you hit a limit. And I'd realized working with the VAX tapes that, yes, this is what I'm good at. It's hardware. I know how to do it. It's a logical problem. I like logic. Sometimes physics isn't always logical. Neither is astronomy. But I think that's really what got me on that track, even though I have my degree and then I was doing science stuff at Goddard, but I realized I missed pounding my head against a wall about a system problem.
Sure. So I didn't start out in CS either. I was a chemistry major, and I got the chemistry degree, but I had a bunch of friends who were CS majors, and I really got the strong sense going through school that they were learning a class of material that was pretty different from what I was learning in chemistry. In chemistry, I was sort of learning the history of chemistry for 4 years. And I saw my friends taking computer science, really learning a toolbox full of tools for solving arbitrary problems in the world, and that seemed incredibly powerful and compelling. And I was like, I have to get in on this. So I tried. I was in the last... the very last offering of 6001, which is MIT's semi-famous intro to CS class taught in Lisp, which is now defunct, and was totally hooked. Hooked to the point that I actually got an internship, or we called it a Europe at MIT. It was like an on-campus apprenticeship of dubious legality in the CS department while also having a chemistry Europe. But I was totally hooked. So like the power of CS was very evident to me from the beginning as soon as I took a class. But that wasn't, so that is a thing. That was what I mostly wanted to say. I wanted to mention that a pivotal point for me was my very first experience in an open source project. Because I think for a lot of women, this is either not an experience because they don't do it at all, or it's potentially a negative experience. And I had a really positive experience that I would like to share. I was an intern at VMware in college, and I was sort of like an obnoxious young intern, and I was using this Python library called Twisted, and was sort of muttering to other interns some week, man, their documentation totally sucks. Like, what the heck, this project sucks, this documentation sucks. Okay, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna go send an email to their mailing list saying their documentation sucks. And so I did that, and I was like, can I help you? Because your documentation sucks. Probably what should have happened is that someone yelled at me for being so obnoxious, but instead, like, the project maintainers made what I'm pretty sure is a conscious decision to welcome me, thank me for my commentary, encourage me to submit some patches, said they would help me along the way. And that has turned into sort of years of friendship. It was the first open source project I'd ever contributed to. I am a maintainer for that project now. I'm writing a book with O'Reilly on that project. And it's really because the maintainers, this one guy in particular, his name is Glyph, made a point of making my first experience a positive one. So I'm very fortunate to have had that experience. And it also makes it very clear to me that it's important as we go through our CS careers and our open source careers that we make sure that people are having positive first experiences. And you may not know what their first experience is, so that means you have to make sure everyone is, you try your best to make sure that you're promoting a positive environment everywhere. Because you don't know if that one woman who submitted a really crappy bug report, that could be her first time doing it ever. And you have the opportunity right there to help her decide if this is something she wants to do. It's a big opportunity slash obligation, but I'm now acutely aware of wanting to try to promote that in everyone that comes through my communities. So I would encourage you all to think about that as you go through your careers as well, I guess.
That's great advice.
We call them teachable moments.
Teachable moments. Thank you, Glyph, for that teachable moment.
That actually segues really well into a question I've been thinking about. We've talked a little bit about identifying mentors and finding mentors for yourself, but I think it's equally important to mentor others. Do you guys have any ideas or tips or anything on even small things, some of us, in case we're, you know, early in our careers, things we can do to be a good mentor to other women that we may see?
Yes, I just tell all of the women that I know who are awesome and technical to, whenever a conference rolls around, you should submit a talk. You should submit a talk. You should go to this conference. You should talk at this user group event. I could just tell them that they should do it. And I'm just constantly asserting to the women that I know who are great to go out and do these things. Because some of them wouldn't do it without repeated prodding. And in my experience, the best way to get women stepping into leadership positions is to just tell them they have to do it. So I spend a lot of my time doing that.
I agree. That's good advice.
Sure. as an organizer for the Boston Python User Group, one of the things that we've constructed is a programming pipeline for getting more women into the Python community. And we take a sort of unique tack with this in that we don't construct a separate space for women. We run events as part of the existing community. So we run every couple of months Intro to Python events for women. It's a sort of a custom curriculum that was really carefully designed to be appropriate for even absolute beginners. And people forget what it means to be an absolute beginner with programming. So we're very conscientious of this. It's hands-on, it's applied, it's very low pressure, it's free. We have sponsorship from the Python Software Foundation, so there's no financial commitment, which puts up a sort of a burden in people's minds sometimes. So we run this pipeline and we have follow-up events and we work very hard to integrate women into the user group and get them to step up into leadership positions as they go through this pipeline. And this is a thing that we've been running for the past 18 months. We've had over 200 women go through the program. We have taken the user group from approximately 0% women to consistently over 15% at all user group events. These are large events, so like 100, 120 people. So both in absolute numbers and as a percentage, a huge improvement in the past 18 months. We've had tremendous community support. I think the Python programming community has really been a leader for programming languages in this space. We've received grants. We've received a Sisters Pass It On grant from the Anita Borg Foundation to keep working on this. It's been replicated in a couple of cities in the US, Philadelphia, Washington, DC, Indianapolis, Portland is coming up soon. So we have big plans. The Boston Ruby community is now emulating our philosophy of working with the user group. So that's the thing that we're doing, and it's really exciting. And it's exciting that it seems you know, our goal was to have long-term measurable success, and we seem to actually be achieving that. So that's really exciting. So this tack of working within existing communities seems to be an effective one. If people are interested in doing like open source or programming language community outreach, I would love to talk to you.
I'm going to continue on with the mentoring before Carolyn comes up here. I've done a lot of mentoring in the model rocket community, doing model rockets for the kids and for women, and I don't think I've ever thought to turn around and try to do it in the system admin world, because most of the women that I work with are at the same level or a little bit above me. And I have to stop and think about, well, what would happen if, hopefully, if a young woman came and said, I really want to be a system admin, I would know what to do, because I've mentored in another thing. So if you haven't mentored in computers, but you've mentored in another area, I still consider the fact that I'm mentoring model rocketeers and getting kids to think, yeah, rocket's fun, science is fun, physics is fun, that it's still a good thing, even if it may not channel them into the computer stuff, it at least is channeling them into a science, a technology, or something like that. So I just, that's how I was thinking about it. I really haven't mentored a sysadmin, but I've definitely done enough rocketeers.
All right. Thank you, Caroline. That's a question. First, I want to say I'm really impressed. You're all wonderful role models.
Aww.
If we could all just feel as confident as you are demonstrating right now, that'd be awesome.
Act as if.
So I want to ask a completely off to the left question. Men are the other gender, and there are a couple in this room right now. So how can we open a conversation with them about advancing women, and what could they do to help us?
So first of all, I think we should commend all of those who took the time to come and spend the day with us, because that's the first step. So thank you. And I think a couple of the messages that have come out are things that I'm guessing these people will bring back to their organizations, right? Notice when the woman is being overlooked and speak up, right? You don't need a mentor of the same gender, right? I think several of us mentioned men who were our mentors. So, you know, it's not just us who have to do it. There are partners in this too. So I think those are a bunch of really great first steps. And I think the second step is each of you guys and each of you gals should find two of your, you know, male or female friends to bring next year so that we can make the discussion bigger and start to broaden out a little bit.
I'm actually kind of curious that the gentleman in the audience, what would you like to get out of this meeting? You know, what were you hoping to learn, to hear, to gather?
I asked myself that, and I realized there's probably more reasons for me to be here than anywhere else. I'm trying to figure out how we can better recruit women at Facebook. I'm trying to figure out, there's a 50% chance that I'll be a father of a girl by the end of the year.
All right, woohoo!
I don't know the gender yet, but I know they're going to be a programmer. So, you know, I manage women sometimes on tech lead projects, and I just kind of want to understand, because Facebook, like a lot of tech organizations, is not doing as good a job as we should recruiting and encouraging women engineers. I also volunteer at schools teaching, and that's one of my passions. And we need to promote more young, like, you know, middle school girls to program as well. So that's why I'm here.
All
and
right, thanks.
A lot of good points from all of you so far. I'm taking notes and sending them to our engineering managers. Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to just follow up with Margot's point. So I didn't talk about my mentor, but thinking back, I don't actually have a person that I went to for advice. But in my whole career, I had a lot of management and really senior technical people. They just always let me do whatever I wanted to do. Whatever I did, I would go over to tell them, say, hey, don't you think this is super awesome? And they would always go, yeah, that's super awesome. So that positive feedback loop, I think, had really helped me and made me more and more confident. And I always thought, I would always go to them, say, I have a brilliant idea. And afterwards, no matter what idea that I had, they would say, oh, that was a brilliant idea. So I think that kind of encouragement is really a positive in helping a female engineer to develop. So you can make a point of doing that. Oh, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, that's super awesome.
Oh, so actually, I forgot about all my standard list of logistical things you can all bring home to your home organizations. So here's your homework. One, go to your company website and look at the pictures and images there and ask yourself, what do they say about women at your company? So I was recently asked to be on a panel at EMC World where they were having a specific women's event. And so I went to the EMC World website. I could find nothing about the event. the pictures on the website were not all that welcoming to women. And so there was sort of a mixed message, and I am planning on following up. But then I went to Oracle's website to ask the same questions because I work there, and I was not overly impressed either with the imagery on the Oracle site, which tends to be men talking to women. And I was also not impressed with the gender ratio at Open Oracle World of sort of the big speeches. So one thing you can do, male or female, is go home, look at your company's website, and see what message you are sending to the world about the gender ratio in your company. So that's number one. Number two, if you are at a big company that has a university relations group, buy the women's shirts. Okay, this sounds really obvious. But I kid you not, I stood with university relations of a very, very large corporation hearing them whine at me about how they couldn't recruit women. And I looked at the women in university relations, I said, is that a men's polo shirt? And they said, yes. And I said, why? They said, well, there aren't very many of us and it would be more expensive. And I said, my company has 25 people. We buy men's polo shirts and women's polo shirts. It's not that expensive. But I'm serious, when you send your women out to recruit and you're making them wear men's polo shirts that don't look good on them, what are you telling the women? Not a good message. Google gets it right. They actually, I have this wonderful Google sweatshirt with a Google logo with a little women's symbol in it. Kudos to Google. They actually acknowledge that women want swag too. This is good. But these sound like stupid things, but they send messages. And if you're trying to recruit at the university and the message you give people is, we're guys, what a shock that you don't recruit any women.
I've had male and female mentors, but one really strong mentor I had, I remember I hadn't worked at the company very long, and after we had a conference call and everybody got off, my phone rang and it was him, and he was like, why didn't you speak up? You know, and he did stuff like that to me all the time, and I'm sure he regretted it later. It didn't take long, and I was like, all right, you want me to speak up, I'll do it, you know. And he's the one that encouraged me to start my Women in Open Source blog that I did while I was in grad school, which I ended up having for several years, and it ended up doing a lot for me. I don't know how much it helped other people, but I got to meet so many people from, you know, having that blog, and I wouldn't have thought of it had he not suggested it. So just, you know, making suggestions and then calling me out when he saw that I was doing things that weren't helping my career. And I don't know if he would have done that for men. I don't know that he had to, you know, but that helped me probably more than anything. Was I just remember that phone call so vividly. Do we have any other questions?
We have a few more minutes. I did have a question. Somebody else brought up earlier, and I don't remember who. Somebody said something about women having to know more than their male counterparts. I don't remember who brought that up.
Okay, yeah, which I thought was very true, and I've seen that quite a bit. And I know I've certainly had to do that, where I felt like I had to know just enough to cause a little trouble if I had to, you know? And so I'm wondering if anyone else had those experiences or have them now.
So I definitely feel that way. I definitely feel like I have to know more. And I think that's, but, and then there's this wonderful guy by the name of George Cameron. He said, if you ask Sherry how much she knows about the kernel, she would say, no, maybe only 2%. If you ask Eric, you know, how much he knows about the kernel, he would say, 2%. You know, so I think it's really probably the attitude. I think somebody mentioned that the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know. I think female in general felt that, oh, there's so much more I don't know, and they kind of feel kind of insecure. But all the guys would feel, wow, I already know so much. You know, the 2%, they feel very strongly about the 2%. Instead of like women, they feel, you know, very insecure about the 2%. So I think it's really how you feel about it more than whether or not you actually need to know more about it. You need to feel really confident that you know that 2% really, really well when you stand in front of a crowd or giving a presentation. You need to know that I probably know a lot more about this stuff than anybody in the audience, or I know more about this stuff than anybody in the meeting. So when you feel that way, I think you can project the confidence and people will listen to you rather than, I'm not so sure, and then nobody will listen to you. If you don't feel confident about yourself, nobody else will. So.
Do we have any other questions?
I'm curious about,
Mike. We're recording.
It's so loud. I can't.
No, it's because we're recording.
You won't go on the recording otherwise.
We've talked a lot about women in IT and a little bit about work-life balance. And I just wondered if it's come up. I've been very fortunate to work in women-owned company, women-run company, you know, women always on the board. And I find it a little hard as a mother of three sometimes to validate my work-life balance because they have the same issues. And I just wondered how all of you kind of make that work.
This is one of my favorite topics. So I think part of it is just being, again, it's all about being confident in what your decisions are. And so in my case, I was the first woman to ever have a child in the entire school of engineering. Well, I was only the second woman, so. So they'd never dealt with issues of like maternity leave. So I walked up to my dean and I told him I was expecting. And he's like, okay, what are you gonna do? And I said, well, I'm going to co-teach in the fall because the baby's due in December, and then I'm going to bring the baby into the office with me for the spring. And he said, okay. So kudos to him. I don't think he really thought about what he was doing, but that's okay. And so I took my kid to work for 7 months. And there are some environments in which this really doesn't work, but there are environments in which it actually can work. And again, it never occurs to us to ask. And it wouldn't have occurred to me except actually one of my college classmates, who also now works at Oracle, having come through Sleepy Cat and everything else, she had done this because she worked for a really tiny startup. And I thought, what a cool idea. I can like be a mom and be at work, and isn't this great? And it was the most fabulous thing in the world. And I think outside the box. Figure out what works for you, right? This worked for me. I have another colleague who's also a professor who was like, oh my God, that so wouldn't have worked for me. Then don't do it. But I think feel free to make decisions that work for you and figure out how to juggle this. So, you know, I have a lot of responsibilities at this conference this week, but my kid is graduating from eighth grade tomorrow, and I somehow am organizing their graduation party. And, you know, today was awards day, and yesterday was this, and so I'm juggling. I'm not here as much as I normally would be. And you know what? That's okay. Everything will go just fine.
I like to joke with my manager, and I try not to do it too often because they'll write me up one of these days about, well, I'm going to work an alternate work schedule. I'm taking every other Friday off because if you don't give it to me, I'm going to go postal. I don't have children, and sometimes they look at me and go, well, you don't have children. You can do all this stuff. It's like, it doesn't mean anything. I still have other obligations and things I want to do. Early on in my career, I sometimes felt like, well, you don't have the child. You don't have children. You can stay late. You can do this. It's like, you're not really contributing to society because you don't have a child. It's like, well, talk to all my, what I call my rocket children, who I've seen grow up and they're now in college, and the kids that I mentor. It's like, no, I think I'm contributing. But in order for me to do that, you need to let me have my every other Friday off. And I've been very lucky in that my government side, the woman retired, and I have a guy who's actually got a PhD in chemistry. He goes, No. Family always comes first. My office mate has two kids, lives an hour and a half from where we are, drives down to, you know, down and back, and has a really weird work schedule. And he's like, no, family always comes first. Your job is always going to be here. And she was taught that early on in life. She had to be on bed rest. And she was talking to some scientists, and he's like, look, go home and be on bed rest. The work's always going to be here. We're still going to be here. It's more important you go take care of your child and have your child healthy, all this other stuff. So I've been lucky in the environment that I have is, even if you, whether you don't have a child or you do have a child, your work life is good. Do what you need to do. Do what you need to make you happy, because if you don't come to work happy, it kind of affects everything else. So I very much always push for my alternate Fridays off. So
which is nice because then I don't go postal.
I have a 14-year-old who just graduated from 8th grade, and I have an 11-year-old boy who is, he's really fun. I'm probably not the best example because I work a lot. I remember I was leading the most difficult project, the dynamic reconfiguration. If any of you system administrators are familiar with the SIN systems, I was leading the dynamic reconfiguration project when my son was born. It was really difficult. I would put him to bed. He didn't sleep through the night, obviously. So I would go back to work. I work until 2 a.m. every day. I would be up at 5 in the morning. I did that for about 5 years. But I think I truly love what I do, and that to me was not a sacrifice. I didn't feel that was a sacrifice. And at the same time, I feel so fortunate to have my children, have my life outside work, because I think Linus, I don't know if you guys all know Linus, his license plate is Dad of Three. So to him, writing the operating system is a hobby. It's his job is a father, and he's really working so that he can be a father. So sometimes I don't know if that's true for me. And I think if you don't step out of your work to really live your life, and you'll lose your perspective. You won't know what's really truly important. And I think the most important thing is that you really have to enjoy every step of it. If you feel at any moment that you're making a sacrifice, and you will regret it for sure, because later you will feel like you might not be getting the reward that you're hoping for. And for me, since I felt that, I was really loving both, and I lucked out, but it was really difficult for me.
I feel like I should say something from the... We're talking about sort of in the long term life balance, and then my youthful perspective is on like the startup, intense startup, all in side, and that situation is a little different. And I guess I'd be interested in the experiences of people who've done this repeatedly. So my experience is like the reason why the founders of the startup wanted me is because they knew that I was good and that I would be all in. And we worked really hard 6 days a week, and you know, it was all startup all the time. So I guess I want to say that you know, for some people there's a time in their lives where I want it to be clear that that women, if they want to, are capable of committing to the same level that men are if they want to do something like a startup while they're young or while they're old. And that women shouldn't be afraid of doing that either, if that's what they want to do. So work-life balance is necessary and awesome in the long term, but depending on what your priorities are right now, make sure you express that you're able to commit yourself like that. Because I think that sometimes there's a perception that women won't.
Well, I think that's probably a good note to end this on because we are out of time. And I wanted to thank everybody for participating. I thought it was a really interesting discussion. And thank you, everybody, for coming. And we are going to have a brief break now.